It's Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's golden era. Welcome, I'm your host, Mark LeBonier. In this hour, True History. Later on, we hear You Are There, where Lee rides to meet Grant, as if CBS News was there. But right now, it's Eyes Aloft, a war-era broadcast from NBC, heard on November 30th, 1942, dedicated to the aircraft warning service watching the skies for enemy planes during the Second World War. Gain Whitman, the host, Ben Alexander, announces.
The National Broadcasting Company presents Eyes Aloft.
Army flash. One, single, very low, scene, 4 Marsha 18, overhead, southeast.
Eyes aloft, watching the sky, watching for planes flying the lanes up above. Eyes aloft.
Eyes aloft. The 4th Fighter Command of the United States Army Air Forces, in cooperation with West Coast radio stations, presents this series of programs honoring the 150,000 volunteer civilian observers and filter center workers whose round-the-clock vigilance keeps watchful guard of the Pacific coast against attack by enemy planes.
Eyes aloft, night and day, we'll help protect the USA.
This is Ben Alexander speaking for Ken Carpenter, your regular announcer, who went east to help describe the Army-Navy football game. Tonight, the 16th edition of Eyes Aloft. And here, going on watch for the next half hour, is your popular narrator, Gain Whitman.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Just recently, we made a hurried trip up the coast. Met and talked with many ground observers, filter center workers, area supervisors, and county directors. Well, here's an example of a type of fellow who makes everybody burn a little. He knows everything about everything. He talks a lot, stalls a lot, and drives other observers on watch half-batted.
Did I tell him where to get off at?
Hey, look, Jake. Plane's flying over. You going to report it or shall I?
No, I'll do it, Ned. I'll do it. I think I heard it first, anyway.
Okay, but report it. It'll be gone before you get around to it.
Oh, I know how to report a plane. Don't be so... Let me see here. Oh, yeah. Crank the phone handle. Not used to this type of phone. Never remember whether you pick up the receiver and then crank or crank and then pick up the receiver. Hello, Central.
Hurry up, Jake. Just say Army Flash.
Hey, I'm making this report. Hello, Army Flash.
Army, go ahead, please.
Well, now, listen. I'll tell you, a plane just flew over.
Do you wish to make a report, sir?
Well, of course. Why do you think I'm bothering to call? The plane was headed out over that clump of sycamore trees to the southeast.
Will you please make the report according to the regular Army
Corps? Let me make the call, Jake.
Will you get away, Ned? You're making me sore.
Oh, for the love.
Hello, operator.
Yes, of course. This is a busy switchboard. Make your report, if you will.
Okay, I am. Don't get huffy with me, young woman. I'll report you to the Army or something. Are you ready?
Yes, of course.
Follow that model report blank tacked over the phone there in front of you.
Oh, this. Yeah, sure. I'll give it according to this.
I can't even hear the plane motor now.
Army flash.
Go ahead, please.
Well, I am. One.
One.
By motor.
By.
But, Jake, wait
high.
A minute.
High.
Now, wait, Jake.
Heard. Nine, Ben, four.
Nine, Ben, four.
South.
Oh.
South. Thank you.
Yeah. What a stupid operator at that filler center. Wonder who that dame was.
Jake, you burned me up.
Oh, yeah? Well, what's eating you, brother?
You said the plane that went over 5 minutes ago was a bimotor.
That's right.
How come you're so sure it might have been a multimotor?
Oh, yeah?
You said it was high. You said it was going south. You know we can't give exact information when we only hear a plane in this mountain pass we're in.
I know what I'm doing.
You know?
Sure, I know.
And you must have eyes like a cat and ears to match.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. You only heard that plane. You couldn't see it. Why, it's pitch dark and raining besides.
Well,
you don't know whether it was going south or straight up.
Well, it could have been going south.
You're one of those guys who know everything.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Always better to say unknown than to give out information of which you are not positive. Think of the poor filterer who is trying to give the operations board a true picture. Don't confuse her. There have been several planes remain unidentified because of such incorrect reports. Gosh, why will they do it? Well, what kind of a vote do you want to give that bird, a boo or a laurel? We're with you 100%. Don't be a Mr. Know-It-All. Don't have your gang secretly pointing its finger behind your back and saying, why will they do it? Now, the ever-popular, colorful little feature of our program, the McKinley Diary. Unedited excerpts from the famous little black-and-white notebook. Comments jotted down by the observers of the McKinley, Oregon Post. Winter has come to the green little mountain valley. Winter and skies that are more often gray and dull. Through the skies these days, dark arrows of wild duck and goose wing southward. But their honking is only noted by the watchers at the little observation post. The watchers are not there to listen for the call of feathered flyers. Rather, to hunt the skies for other birds. Birds man-made. The watchers know that as long as war persists, perhaps someday a bird of prey, a black-winged vulture with the yellow markings of a rising sun, may swoop down bent on some deadly mission. And so the people of the valley patiently wait and watch. But here, let's step inside the shack. Yes, there is always, open on the table, the McKinley Diary. Let's see what has been written lately. Here, October 24th.
Tonight I came to the post by way of the good old days, horseback. The first time I'd been on a horse since coming to Coos County. Made me think of the many miles we rode after cattle in Jackson County. Two letters came this week from Claude. He says the weather is grand, wherever he is. It's so quiet and peaceful there, no one would know the world is at war. We have sent him 6 V letters since the 1st of September, but he has not received any of them, though his last letter came in 14 days. The night seems longer than usual, but it won't be much longer now till I can go home. This time, I've put in a 9.5-hour watch. Good night, Olive M. Hooper.
Time for one more entry. October 26th.
I'm so thrilled I had the diary brought in so I could write a line or two in it. My lovely neighbors gave me a surprise party before I go to the hospital. They brought me many lovely gifts and good wishes for a speedy return home and restored health. What would this world be without friends? I'm sure a very dreary place. We had a nice car delivered to the post tonight for transportation of observers, which will simplify things considerably. Frankly, I shall be glad when I can get back on the job over at the post again. Until then, thanks to all my friends for their many kindnesses. And keep watching, Mabel O'Sullivan.
And so we close McKinley Diary until another time. Tonight's new and true great American story. This is the story of a man who has served his country alone in a deserted California prison farm camp. Alone, except for a little dog named Trixie. Winter, 1941. Early December. The rocky, barren foothills on the northern slopes of the rugged High Sierras. Nestled down in the hills, some 25 miles off the main gravel highway, Kern County's Road District No. 1 prison camp. But no prisoners at the camp. Only the caretaker there, 64-year-old Charles Holmes. Night has fallen. December 7th.
Trixie! Trixie! Come here, Trixie. Yeah. You got short hair, you doggone little terrier. Don't you know you'll freeze out on a night like this? It rains, it'll snow tonight. Yeah, go on in, Trixie, before you freeze. Yeah, light a lamp. Yeah. There we are. Set you smelling, Trixie, my stew on the stove. All right. We'll eat just as soon as... Hey, stew isn't even steaming. Doggone fire in the stove gone out. Yep, Dead as a mackerel. Must have been gone longer over at the barns than I thought. I'll build a new fire, get a piece of wood from the wood box. Oh, doggone, no wood in the bin. Forgot, I'm out of wood. What's the matter with the county? Don't bring me no wood, don't bring me no supplies. I don't see why. Phone. Oh, some kind of trouble. I'm coming. Hello! Charles Holmes speaking.
Mr. Holmes, you heard the news?
Who's speaking?
Aircraft Warning Service, County Director's Office. Have your radio on today, Mr. Holmes?
I haven't had time for the radio today.
Oh, then you don't know what's happened.
Yes, I know what's happened, but you don't.
Yeah, but
what's happened is this. I'm stuck back here in the hills, and the county's forgot to send me any wood.
Well, I'm out
of wood, and I don't have much food. What do they think my little dog's going to eat? What's the matter with that outfit down there at the county anyway?
Mr. Holmes, listen to me.
Listen to you about what?
The Japs bombed Pearl Harbor this morning.
At Honolulu?
That's it. America's been attacked. President will probably declare war when Congress meets in the morning.
I never have trusted those dirty little Japs.
Now, listen.
Why, I told a friend of mine down at McFarland last year that if this country ever gets in trouble, it'll be the Japs.
Now, Mr. Holmes, I don't have time to talk. We're activating the aircraft warning system now.
Today?
Right now. In fact, a lot of boats are already going.
Well, I thought we were going to get started when the Army held its war. Oh, yeah, see.
Hey, we're starting now. Can we consider your posts operating now, Mr. Holmes?
Yes, sir. Figure I'm on duty. I'll watch for planes. If any Japs fly over my place, I'll call in those flashes. Don't you worry.
Good. Fine.
Say, if you get a chance to call the county and tell them that they'd admit... Oh. Hung up. Well, Trixie, America's at war. Didn't you hear me, Trixie? Well, all right. Speak up. Hey, it's cold in here. No wood. Better light a lantern. Lantern put off a little heat. Yeah, light the lantern.
That night of December 7th, that first night of America at war, Charles Holmes sat in his frame building on the deserted prison farm back in the foothills of the Sierras and listened for planes. As the bitterly cold night passed, no fire in the stove for lack of wood, as the early morning hours dragged on, Mr. Holmes waited. Listened alone, except for his faithful little dog.
Yeah, all right, Trixie, stop shivering. I'm cool, too. Must have hit zero outside by now. You know, Trixie, I've been thinking man has to sleep sometime. If they leave me up here alone to watch for planes, I'll still have to get some sleep. Trixie, you think you could learn to watch for planes and warn me when the plane comes over if I'm asleep? You'll have to bark and kind of wake me up. And wait a minute. What's that? Yes, sir, a plane, I bet you. Gotta be sure. Yeah, there it is, Trixie. Look, see those lights up there? No. Up there, Trixie. Look. That's it. A bark. An airplane, Trixie. Bark. Oh, that'd never wake me up. An airplane, Trixie. Bark. Come on, bark. Bark. That's it. Got a report. It's flying south. Get it, Trixie? We're running this post, you and me. From now on, you got to bark whenever you hear an airplane. Smart little devil. Hello, operator. Operator. Yeah, now, look, I got to make a call about an airplane. Got to make an army flash. Connect me with whoever I got.
One moment, please.
Trixie, do you understand now? When you hear an airplane, you bark. If I'm asleep, you keep on barking until... What's the matter with me? You don't understand. What can I expect from a dog?
Army, go ahead, please.
One.
Single.
High.
Scene.
34, Beatrice 6.
34, Beatrice 6.
Overhead.
Southeast, thank you.
Well, you see, it was going over north. Oh, it's hung up. Yeah, guess you caught on to what I was saying. Oh, now stop your whimpering, Trixie. Oh, you poor little devil. You're as cold as I am. Well, got to keep on guard. Get this old blanket, the lantern down here on the floor by my feet. Now, come on, Trixie, you get down here beside it, between my feet. Come on. That's it. Now, put the blanket over my knees, and you'll keep warm. At least half of me, my upper part, will keep warm. Yeah. Streak of gray coming over to the east by the mountains. Be morning by and by. Yeah, gotta keep watch. And you've got to help out, Trixie, do you hear me? Got to learn to bark when you're in an airplane. You understand?
Yeah.
A light snow fell around the desolate prison camp that dawn. At 7 o'clock that morning, a road district truck pulled up in front of Holmes Caretaker's building.
You birds stay in the cab till I come out. Don't forget, I got my eye on you all the time.
Yeah, we ain't going no place, chum.
We don't want to sit out here in the cold all day.
Okay, I'll be right back.
Well, hello. It's about time you got here. You bring me any wood?
Yeah, I brought you a load of wood, Mr. Holmes.
Bring me some canned stuff?
2 weeks' supply, sure.
Well, you're late. You county fellas down in civilization forget about me.
Look, I brought you some prisoners.
Say, don't you fellas know there's a war going on? Don't you know I'm running an army observation post up here? And
now, hold on, Mr. Holmes.
Huh?
That's why we brought you a couple of prisoners. They're going to keep watch, too.
Yeah? Well, I got to do what I say. Bring them in. Take them over to their living quarters after they get warmed up. Bring them in. I'll give them a hot bowl of stew.
For breakfast? Stew?
Yeah, stew. What else you think you got left to eat up here? Go on, bring them in. Trixie, you get back over there by that lantern. Keep warm. We got company. We also got some wood to make a fire and get warmed up with.
December dragged on. Christmas came and went. Then New Year's. And Charles Holmes and his little dog, Trixie, did the work of keeping watch for planes. Did the prisoners help? Sure, they helped, like this.
I got a jack and a 10. I took you, buddy.
Okay, here I pay. 8 more matchsticks.
If these matchsticks was bucks, I'd be in the gravy. Hey, can't you keep that mutt quiet, Holmes?
That dog's getting on my nerves.
And you monkey, shut up. I want to listen. Yeah, it's a plane, okay. Now, you can stop it, Trixie, thanks. No, I'll stop it, Trixie. I got it. Okay, bud, put in that army flash.
Who?
You.
Me?
Either one of you.
Yeah, but which one of us?
Get to that telephone, Blackie.
Okay. Don't get excited, Dad.
Plane is passing right overhead. One of them, single motor, heading north. Now make the call.
You mean call now?
Now. You know what I want you to do.
Yeah, but you mean now?
Maybe the old man don't mean now, Blackie.
Are you going to make that call before that plane gets out of sight, or am I going to get my...
Keep your shirt on, Pappy. I'm calling.
Tell the dame that I get out of stir in March.
I get out in February. I'm talking for myself.
Operator.
Hiya, baby. Hey, this is the Duke of the Sierras. I want to talk to the Army about a nasty old airplane that's flying right over our shack.
One moment, please. Army flag.
Hey, what's the matter with you birds? Don't you know this kind of work is important to the Army?
So important? What, do they let an old dumpy like you handle it for,
if there was any way to get out of this spot, I'd go.
There's the door, mister. You can start walking if you think you can make it. It's only 25 miles.
Army, go ahead, please.
Hey, listen, honey.
Army, go ahead, please.
Hey, what's your name, cutie pie?
Do you want to report a plane?
Oh, eventually, but right now I want to talk to a dame, see? My name's Ferdinand. What are you doing tonight,
Give
huh?
me that phone.
What's the idea of jerking that out of my hand?
Sit down.
Well, you don't have to get tough,
I'll
see?
Get tough.
Better take it easy, Blackie.
Army flash.
Go ahead, please.
We lost a little time here, but one.
One.
Single.
Single.
High.
High.
Scene.
Scene.
34 Beatrice 6.
34 Beatrice 6.
Overhead.
Overhead.
North.
North. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, that plane was sure up the... hung up. Say, what's the matter with you rubes? Don't you know America's at war?
So what?
Don't you know the citizens have got to help the Army?
We ain't citizens. We're prisoners. Let them take care of us.
Well, I'm glad all prisoners aren't like you. And I'm calling up the authorities and telling them to come and get you ducks out of here by tomorrow.
The change will be delightful, Dad.
My dog, my poor, dumb little old dog, has got more loyalty and patriotism than you two blockheads have got. So you don't want to help America in this war, huh?
In the months that slowly rolled by, Charles Holmes, caretaker, rolled up more and more hours as an airplane watcher. Prisoners came, and he sent them away. 28 of them came and went. Only one or two were diligent about reporting planes. But Holmes had to keep constantly on the alert, he and his little dog, Trixie. In March, a repetition of the December incident happened. He was again the forgotten man. Once again, the county man who was supposed to bring Mr. Holmes his twice-a-month supplies failed to show up. He and the dog were alone at the camp. Firewood was gone. It was cold. The last can of food was opened and eaten. A day passed, no food, no word from the outside world. And finally, on the second morning, Charles Holmes grew angry. He packed his few belongings into a little satchel and was going to leave.
County. I'm going to take a county job and that guy forgets me. Okay, so I'm through. I'm done. Trixie? Come here, Trixie. Think you can walk 24 miles down to the highway where we can flag a car? Well, you want to stay here and starve? Hey, what's the matter with you, you little mutt? You follow me, I'm going. The county can't do this to me. Now, get out, Trixie. Come on, come on. What's the matter with you? Somebody else can have this job. Doggone county. Trixie, come on! Oh, Trixie, what are you hanging back for? We're leaving this place now. You come on. Oh, what's the matter with you? Lying down on your belly? Now you get up. All right, if you won't get up, I'll carry you till we get away. Come on, dog. Get you away from here. Oh, keep quiet, Trixie. What's the matter with you?
Hey, Trixie, let go!
Jumped out of my arm. Trixie, you come back here. Oh, gosh, she's running around in circles like she's gone crazy. Hey, wait a... Hey, that's an airplane. Wait, Trixie, be quiet. I heard it. All right, you told me an airplane. Three airplanes. Yeah, there it is, coming over the South Hill. Get right back and telephone in a flash. Gotta make a report. Trixie knew there was a plane coming. Army flash.
Army, go ahead, please.
Three.
Three.
Bimotor.
Bimotor.
Low.
Low.
Scene.
Scene.
Oh, Trixie, stop it. 34, Beatrice 6.
34, Beatrice 6.
Overhead.
Overhead.
East.
East. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, Trixie, what's the matter with you? Oh, you trying to tell me I shouldn't have pulled up and left without anybody left here to handle the Army's business? All right. I promise you I won't do it again. Now, stop that barking. Gosh, what if I hadn't been here to report those planes? What if other people quit their post, too? Well, Trixie, I'll never quit this one. Oh, now, wait a minute. Come back. What are you sniffing at that door for? Someone outside, you think? Huh? Well, as I live and breathe. Trixie, you know everything, don't you? Here's that doggone county truck coming. Yeah, with food and wood. I guess they didn't forget us after all. By golly, Trixie, food or no food, wood or no wood, we're sticking right here and reporting those planes until America wins this war. Hmm? What do you got to say to that, Trixie? You really mean that? By golly, you're some smart little dog. Yeah, I tell you.
And today, back there on a desolate prison camp, and you couldn't budge him from his post, back there in the foothills of the High Sierras, sits 64-year-old Charles Holmes and his little dog, who warns him when he sleeps of the approach of flames. Charles Holmes has a 100% efficiency record. Charles Holmes says he has put in only a little over 4,000 hours watching for planes. Only 4,000 hours. Yes. But Charles Holmes won't take credit from Trixie. She, too, has at least 4,000 hours to her credit. We pay honest tribute to these two loyal Americans.
Each week, we present the National Broadcasting Company's Eyes Aloft Gold Trophy Award to some outstanding observation post or filter center. Here now is Colonel Ernest Moon, first executive officer of the General's headquarters staff, to make this week's presentation. Colonel Moon.
Love for country cannot be explained. If it is implanted in a man's heart, nothing can ever disturb it. Loyalty burns fervently in the heart of men like Charles Holmes. It is little enough to recognize his courage, his valor, his loyalty. So to that isolated one-man post, yes, to one man and a little dog, we pay tribute. We present them with the trophy which shall stand in all its glory in a faraway shack in the hills of the High Sierras. We present Charles Holmes and his dog with the handsome Eyes Aloft Gold Trophy Award.
This is Jane Whitman telling you that next week, Eyes Aloft will present a special December 7th memorial program. Now, good night to the 150,000 Aircraft Warning Service volunteer civilians who keep constant vigil of our home front so that America will be safe from any attack by air. Good night.
Eyes Aloft on Tuned to Yesterday from November 30th, 1942 on NBC. The program had some urgency as it first went on the air in August of 1942 with the United States' involvement in the Second World War less than a year old. The writer of the series, Robert L. Redd, traveled the 25,000 miles of coastline to interview citizens and, of course, members of the Aircraft Warning Service who felt they were under a real threat from enemy planes at that time. It's an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. And now it's on to You Are There, bringing us back to Lee riding to meet Grant to close out the Civil War. As if the technology of news gathering and radio reporting was there, we hear the CBS News unit and traumatic teams combine for this broadcast first heard on November 7th, 1948.
This is Don Hollenbeck for CBS at Confederate Army headquarters near Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia. On this Palm Sunday morning of April 9th, 1865, the moment which eight million men, women, and children of the Confederacy have been expecting and dreading has come. General Robert E. Lee, Supreme Commander of the Southern Forces, has left his headquarters here for a meeting with the command of the Northern Armies, General Ulysses S. Grant. That meeting was arranged at Lee's request, and it can mean only one thing. The gray-haired chieftain of the South is prepared to ask Grant what terms he is willing to offer for the surrender of the Army of Northern Virginia. General Lee is reported to be accompanied by Colonels Taylor and Marshall of his personal staff and by Sergeant Tucker, Chief Courier of the old 3rd Army Corps.
April 9th, 1865, Appomattox. Lee rides to meet Grant. You are there.
An anguished South looks into the face of defeat. CBS takes you back to the final moments of an unforgettable day in the making of the United States of America. All things are as they were then, except for one thing. When CBS is there,
you are there.
You Are There is based on authentic historical fact and quotation. And now,
Lee's headquarters near Appomattox Courthouse and Don Hollenbeck.
Come as a complete surprise. Ever since Grant forced Lee out of his defenses at Petersburg and Richmond last week, the Southern position has become progressively worse. Lee has been retreating across Virginia with 10,000 effectives and 15,000 stragglers, all that is left of the once powerful Army of Northern Virginia, 70,000 strong. Grant's Northern forces number nearly 100,000, including almost three armies, the Army of the Potomac, the Army of the James, and General Sheridan's cavalry. Those Northern armies have overtaken Lee and are now astride his front lines as well as behind him in the Red Hills of Appomattox. Lee made a last desperate attempt this morning to break through on the Lynchburg Pike. He hoped to reach the mountains of southwest Virginia, but the attempt failed. General John B. Gordon, who led the attempted breakthrough, reported to Lee, and I quote him, "I have fought my corps to a frazzle. I can do nothing unless heavily supported." It is believed that General Gordon's failure decided Lee to go and see Grant and ask for surrender. What terms will Grant offer? Will they be acceptable to Lee, to his men? Here is Quincy Howe with an analysis of those questions.
What terms will Grant offer? The best opinion is that those terms will be as they always have been, unconditional surrender. Will they be acceptable to Lee? Probably not. To his men, certainly not. They'd rather fight it out to the death. U.S. Grant. Unconditional surrender Grant. That's what his men call him. Ever since General Grant has commanded a federal army, his terms have always remained inexorable. Unconditional surrender. He made this clear at Fort Donelson. He made it clear again at Vicksburg, where the tragic condition of the Confederate Army, garrison, and civilians did not move him to mercy. His terms have never changed. It was unconditional surrender every time. When Grant took command of all the Northern armies more than a year ago, he publicly announced that he would fight it out against Lee at Richmond if it took all summer. It not only took all summer, it took all autumn and all winter. It also took over 100,000 federal casualties inflicted by the surviving 30,000 men of the Army of Northern Virginia. These casualties earned for Grant the name of Butcher from his own men. If Grant showed no mercy to his own men, why should he show mercy to the enemy, especially now that he has Lee's army trapped by two federal armies, by Sheridan's cavalry, and by the James River on his front flank? 100,000 men against 10,000, odds of 10 to 1. On the other hand, Lee cannot accept unconditional surrender. The record of his Army of Northern Virginia is the most brilliant in the military history of this country. 4 bloody years, its bayonets have carried the Confederate cause. Lee has defeated Grant every time against almost the same odds. He would prefer to fight it out rather than accept what he considers dishonorable terms. As for his men, Ken Roberts with General Longstreet's corps in the rear of the Confederate Army reports that a truce has been arranged. So, over to Ken Roberts.
The truce between the armies of the North and South was personally arranged by General Lee and General Humphrey, representing General Meade, commander of the Federal Army of the Potomac. As far as we can learn, no definite time has been set, but all firing has ceased, both in the front lines and here at the rear. News of the truce was brought by special courier from Lee a few moments ago and announced by General James Longstreet in command of the First Corps. General Longstreet's men are busily throwing up fresh breastworks and digging trenches. General Longstreet is with me now, a veteran of many battles beginning at First Manassas. He was wounded recently in the fighting before Richmond. His right arm is in a black sling. General Longstreet, sir, where is General Lee now?
I would not deign to know.
Well, sir, doesn't the fact that you just received word from General Lee of a truce mean that he's meeting with General Grant?
I have no official confirmation to that effect.
Sir, do you agree with General Lee's decision to ask for terms from General Grant?
General Lee is my immediate superior, the commander-in-chief of the Confederate States Armies of America. It is not for me to agree or to disagree with his decisions, but to carry out his orders.
Will you carry them out if the terms are unconditional surrender?
I will obey any orders from General Lee.
General Longstreet, do you think General Lee will accept unconditional surrender terms?
I shall abide by whatever decision he may make.
Apparently, you expect the decision to be a fighting one, sir. Your men seem to be more concerned with preparing for battle than for peace.
There is no peace yet. There is only a truce.
Well, if the truce should break off,
here comes
sir, and... Oh, excuse me, General Longstreet. A federal cavalry officer is riding in under a white flag of truce. He's coming in not from the rear of this army, where Lee and Grant are supposed to be conferring, but from up toward the front, where Federal General Sheridan's cavalry is blocking the Confederates. He's flanked by 2 Confederate officers. One is Major Hunter, and the other is Captain Sims, I think. Yes, it is Captain Sims. The federal officer is wearing a wide sombrero turned up in his rugged face, and curls, yellow curls hanging loosely over his shoulders, and a gold-trimmed blue sack uniform with a bright red scarf. The federal officer is pulled up now. He just raised his horse back on its haunches with a flourish. Now he's swung himself to the ground. He's wearing the largest shoulder straps of a major general I've ever seen. Huge Mexican spurs, a tremendous saber, pistols in both boots. He's striding over here towards General Longstreet. He's a young man, can't be more than 25. General Longstreet is waiting for him, a scowl on his heavily bearded face. The federal officer is saluting.
In the name of General Sheridan, I demand the unconditional surrender of this army.
And who are you, sir?
I am General Custer.
Oh, the hangman of Front Royal. By what authority do you come into our line, General Custer?
There is authority enough behind me. General Sheridan is in a position to destroy you if you do not surrender at once.
Sir, you are rash, ignorant, and discourteous. Not only to me, your superior in rank, but to your own commander.
I only wish to prevent the spilling of more blood.
I am not the commanding general, my young friend. But if I were, I would receive no communication from you, nor from General Sheridan, nor from any other, underling.
Sir, I... Well, I didn't mean, sir. Well, that is a... Well...
That's good. Since you are now going more moderate in your tone, I will say to you that General Lee is in communication with General Grant.
Yes, sir.
Now go and act as you and General Sheridan choose. And I will teach you a lesson you won't forget.
Yes, sir.
Now go!
Yes, sir.
Well, gentlemen, that did me a world of good.
The federal cavalry officer and his Confederate escort are mounting up. There they go, back toward the front lines where they came from. The tension here has relaxed. The Confederate officers are still chuckling over the tongue-lashing that General Longstreet just administered to the brash and cocky young federal officer. Well, here comes a Confederate courier riding in from the rear of this army. Perhaps he's bringing a message. Yes, it's General Lee's courier. In a moment, we'll have news on the meeting between the two commanding generals. The courier is coming up to General Longstreet
General
now.
General Lee, compliments, sir. He requests that you join him in the front ranks of the army.
Jones, watch it. Come with me.
Let's go.
An order from General Lee that General Longstreet join him up front. The general and his staff are mounting up. I don't know what this means. There's still no word on Lee's meeting with General Grant.
This is Don Hollenbeck at General Lee's headquarters near Appomattox. We've interrupted Ken Roberts. General Lee has failed to meet General Grant. The federal commander did not appear. General Lee has left the rear of his army, and he's now on his way with the staff toward his own front lines on the outskirts of Appomattox. Quincy Howe's here in the studio with me. What do you make of it, Quincy?
Perhaps Grant didn't get Lee's communication last night asking for the meeting. Or if he did get the message, maybe he just couldn't reach the appointed place in time. Another possibility is that he received the request and turned it down because he preferred to attack rather than talk. The fact that the truce is still in effect makes this last possibility kind of unlikely. General Lee is probably riding up to his front lines now to continue his efforts to locate General Grant. That's the best I can make of it, but you've got something new there, haven't you, Don?
I do, Quincy. It looks important. The village of Appomattox Courthouse up beyond the front lines of the Confederate Army has just been declared neutral ground. Picket lines of the opposing armies have been posted on opposite sides of the town, and that suggests that Lee and Grant are now going to meet at Appomattox Courthouse. John Daly up at the Confederate front reports that General Lee has arrived with his staff. Go ahead, John Daly.
General Lee is waiting here for the arrival of a federal courier who will bring Grant's answer to Lee's request for a meeting. If General Grant agrees, the meeting in all probability will be held somewhere in the village of Appomattox Courthouse. The village was declared neutral territory by Generals Gordon and Sheridan. Right now, General Lee is conferring with his lieutenants under an apple tree at the edge of an orchard about 50 yards in front of me here. The general is resting on a crude cot made out of fence rails covered with army blankets, their red color faded from long use. The southern commander is wearing a brand new full-dress uniform. It's hard to tell from here what expression is on his gray-bearded face, but the general looks very solemn as he talks quietly with his aides. There's General Mahone, General Alexander, Colonel Marshall, Colonel Venable, Taylor, Talcott, and, by the way, a cordon of engineers has been thrown around the apple tree to keep back the tattered, barefoot Confederate veterans who, as usual, are pressing around, anxious for a close look at their beloved commander, and this time also for word on the surrender possibilities. General Longstreet is coming up the pike. Coming up from the rear of the army, two staff officers riding with him, one on either side. And now one of General Lee's lieutenants is striding away from that apple tree where the conference has been going on, and he's coming this way. It's General E.P. Alexander. He's the foremost artillerist in the Army of Northern Virginia, a young man. General Alexander.
Yes?
Sir, can you tell us when the courier from General Grant is expected to arrive?
I'm not familiar with the movements of the enemy.
You've just been talking to General Lee, sir, and I've...
General only asked me for my opinion.
What did you tell him?
I told him that we have fought under him for 4 years. and we have a right to ask one favor of him.
What favor is that, sir?
We want him to let us fight it out.
But, General Alexander, suppose you did fight your way out, some of you. Where would you go?
We could join General Johnson in North Carolina. Maybe we could return to our respective states. We could rally behind our governors. Anything is better than giving up anything.
Don't you think, sir, that guerrilla warfare would be hopeless?
If we must die, sir, we'll die like Jeb Stuart in the saddle with guns in our hands, not rotting away in some northern prison. Our comrades, sir, did not die for us to break faith with them. They did not die, sir, by the thousands at Manassas, Chancellorsville, Fredericksburg, the Wilderness, and Gettysburg for us to dishonor their blood. No, sir. A little more blood spilled won't make any difference. We have a right to die for a cause we think is just, sir. We have a right
General
to
Courier!
Die.
Excuse me, General Alexander. A federal officer is riding down the hill from Appomattox Village, escorted by a federal cavalryman carrying a white flag. And General Lee, at the edge of the apple orchard, has risen. General Longstreet, with him now, is saying something to him. Longstreet joined the group under the tree when he rode up just a minute or two ago. The federal officer is dismounting, and he must be the courier General Lee has been waiting for, the courier from Grant. The federal courier is a colonel, perhaps a staff aide with that rank. He's talking to General Lee now, and the soldiers about here have stopped talking. Everyone is silently watching that little group under the apple tree. We'll know in a moment whether the meeting between the two is to... Oh, General Lee is getting up on his horse. Colonel Marshall, too, the General Lee's aide and his orderly, Sergeant Tucker. General Lee and his aides are riding away now up the hill toward Appomattox Courthouse. It didn't take very long. That federal officer and the cavalryman carrying the white flag are with them, and Lee is on his way to meet General Grant. The long-awaited meeting is about to take place. This is John Daly, and I return you now to Confederate headquarters and Don Hollenbeck.
CBS has been given permission to pass Ned Calmer through the Confederate picket lines into the village of Appomattox Courthouse. He's on his way there now in a mobile unit. As soon as he's ready to report, we'll take you to Appomattox. Now, here's Quincy Howe.
Just imagine, if you can, the mental and spiritual tortures which General Robert E. Lee must be suffering now as he rides to meet Grant at Appomattox. Uppermost in his mind, there is probably the desperate hope that his merciless opponent in war will reverse himself and prove magnanimous in peace. Honorable terms, that is what Lee wants. Terms commensurate with the honor of his army. For only honorable terms can soothe the open wounds of the proud South. Only with honorable terms can Lee return to his men down here in the valley and say, "We have lost, but we have lost with honor. We must forget the past. We must think of the future. We must think of our children." But suppose General Grant does not offer honorable terms. Then General Lee must face his men and say, "The enemy is inflexible. The end does not yet come. We must fight on." Surely his heart feels compassion for the Southern women and children anxiously awaiting the return of their husbands, fathers, and sons. He must be thinking, too, of the men who fought and died for the Stars and Bars and of their widows and orphans. Does he also fear the terrible vengeance that the radical northern politicians have threatened against his southern countrymen? And don't forget all the might-have-beens that must be passing through General Lee's mind. If Jackson had survived Chancellorsville, if Beauregard had stormed on into Washington after First Manassas, if a courier hadn't lost Lee's orders at Sharpsburg, if Wilcox had reinforced Pickett at Gettysburg, a few different turns of the wheel of fate, and Lee might have awaited Grant at the surrender table. If only... Just a minute. Ned Calmer is ready to report from Appomattox Courthouse. Go ahead, Ned Calmer.
Generals Robert E. Lee and Ulysses S. Grant are at this moment conferring on terms for the surrender of the Army of Northern Virginia. The conference is going on inside a two-story red brick house owned by a Mr. McLean. I'm on the front porch of that house now. The only Confederates inside are General Lee and his aide, Colonel Marshall. With General Grant are seven federal officers. The conference has been going on for some time. Outside on the porch here are about 20 more federal officers, including General Sheridan and General Custer. The son of the President of the United States, Captain Robert Lincoln, is also here. General Sheridan is with me now at our microphone. General Sheridan, sir, what do you think will be the result of the conference going on inside?
The rebel army is being given a chance to save itself from annihilation by unconditional surrender.
Then you think, sir, that General Grant is insisting on his usual terms?
Certainly. There's no question about it. General Grant is a soldier, not a political bargainer. As a soldier, his business is to destroy Lee's army or force it into unconditional surrender.
Well, do you think General Lee will accept, sir?
Frankly, no. Lee is desperate and bold enough to risk escape by fighting it out with us. In my opinion, this whole thing is a trick, a ruse invented by Lee to gain time for his army to rally for a last stand. And I hope he does. If he wants to fight it out here, we're ready.
Thank you, General Sheridan. The Federal cavalry commander has walked away. He's resumed his pacing up and down here on the porch of the McLean house. The minutes pass very slowly here. The tension is very great. General Lee's orderly out there in the yard has removed the bridles from the three horses in the general's party. He's letting them graze on the young grass. It's a beautiful spring day, a good day for peace. The door has opened. General Lee has come out onto the porch. Federal officers have all risen and saluted. No one speaks. General Lee stands framed in the doorway there. Tall, commanding man, gray-haired, full of gray beard and mustache, deep brown eyes. His brand-new full-dress uniform has three stars on the low collar, a double row of brass buttons, a red sash. The general wears a gold sword, black hip boots, gold spurs. They glint. Now he's putting on his gray felt hat. He's returned the salute of the federal officers who only now have brought their arms back to their sides. General Lee is now crossing slowly to the head of the steps, which lead down into the front yard. A deep crimson flush is rising from his neck, spreading up over his face. He stands at the top of the steps, drawing on his gauntlets. His eyes are fixed intently in the direction of the valley to his right, where his army lies waiting for him less than 1 mile away. He seems strangely oblivious of his surroundings. General Lee just struck his fist into his gloved hand several times. Now he glances to the left and to the right as if looking for something. And
orderly!
He...
Orderly!
General Lee is walking down the front steps. He called to his orderly, who has bridled the horses and is now waiting with them. Now the other officers are coming out the front door. There's the Confederate Colonel Marshall. He's making his way quickly down the steps and over toward the right side of the house where General Lee is mounting his chunky gray horse. Some of the federal officers are descending the steps, but I don't see General Grant yet. He's still inside the house. Now General Lee's orderly, as well as his aide, are riding out of the front yard. Here comes General Grant. He's just come through the door. He's hurrying down the steps on his way to his horse. General Lee is passing him. Grant has stopped. He's taken off his hat. General Lee removes his hat. Not a word is spoken. And now the Confederate chieftain is riding back to his Army of Northern Virginia. And General Grant, dressed in the plain blue uniform of a Federal Army private, has mounted his horse and with his staff is riding up to General Sheridan, who's standing close by here in the yard.
Where do you make your headquarters tonight? Here or there? Right in this yard, probably.
Very well, then. I'll know where to find you in case I wish to communicate. Good day.
Good day, General.
General Grant is riding away. General Sheridan, General Sheridan, sir, what has happened? Has Lee surrendered?
Colonel Babcock, General Grant's aide, is preparing a statement now. We'll give it to all correspondents shortly.
But General, can't you just tell
us? Sorry, you'll have to wait for the official statement.
Thank you, General. As you heard, we'll have that federal statement in just a few moments. John Daly, however, is with the Confederate forces, and General Lee should be arriving there now, down in the valley. Perhaps we can get the information quicker there. So go ahead, John Daly.
General Lee and his aides following behind him are just coming down the Lynchburg Pike from Appomattox. The Confederate soldiers are lining the road here by the apple orchard waiting for him. And a soldier has just cried out, "General, are we surrendered?" General Lee doesn't answer. He's riding straight on through the lines of his men on both sides of the road. Another soldier has shouted the question that's on the minds of all these men. And the cry is now being taken up. They've all taken up the cry. They've come out onto the road and have stopped the general's horse. Again and again, they repeat that heartbreaking cry. Are we surrendered, General? Tell us, are we surrendered? General Lee has taken off his hat now, and he's started to speak. Let's listen.
Men, we have fought through the war together. I've done the best I could for you. So be paroled and go to your homes until exchanged.
Then we have surrendered.
Yes, you are surrendered. But you are surrendered with honor.
The Army of Northern Virginia has surrendered, and here's a message that has just come in. General Grant is sending over 25,000 federal rations to feed the starving Confederate Army, and the men are to be allowed to keep their horses. But in spite of the unexpected generosity of the federal commander, the Confederate soldiers here are shocked with grief. All they can think of is that, regardless of the honorable terms, they have surrendered. Men are throwing away their muskets. Grown men are crying without shame, flinging themselves on the ground, shaking with sobs like children, crying with a fearful and terrible violence, rolling on the grass. Some of the men are still crowding around their gray-haired general, clutching his hand. Some pat his horse, Traveler, smoothing his flank. Tears are rolling down General Lee's cheeks. His eyes, seeing nothing, are fixed on a line between the ears of his horse. This is a grim, tragic moment. 4 years of sacrifice, flaming courage, hope, despair, finally ended in disaster for this army. This is a day that the proud veterans of the Army of Northern Virginia will never forget. A day that marks the futility of raw courage in the great complex of modern war and its machine. For the greatest army ever produced on this continent.
April 9th, 1865. Appomattox. Grant gives Lee honorable terms, and the war between the states is over.
You Are There, on Tuned to Yesterday from November 7th, 1948 on CBS. And that brings to an end this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from Radio's Yesteryear. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levanier. It's been a pleasure.